But it sounded good.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. I'm going to officially open this meeting. It is Tuesday, April 7th, and we are going to have a couple of work sessions that we may jump in the middle and do the work session because folks are going to be kind of in and out. There's a window where some people are coming late and some are leaving early, so we may just kind of interrupt and do work sessions. So we're going to first open a public hearing on House Bill 3099. And do you want to give us a quick summary of that bill?
Yes. Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3099 transfers the duties, functions, powers, and responsibilities related to information technology resources and systems, geographic information systems and data, telecommunications and related services from the Department of Administrative Services to the State Chief Information Officer or State CIO. Provides that the state CIO is the primary advisor to the governor on information technology and telecommunications, specifies duties, functions, and powers of the state CIO. The bill becomes operative January 1st, 2016. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. All right, Barry Pack and Alex Pettit.
I'm sure, can I speak to it first?
Oh, sure. I didn't realize it was yours.
Sorry.
Thank you. Go ahead. What's that? Oh, Senator Riley, you want to speak on this one? All right, come on. Come on up. Come on down.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't mean to interrupt your flow of the bill here. But this is a bill that the Consumer Protection Committee has been working on prior to you becoming chair for several years. And it does have to do, I think the committee administrator correctly identified the bill. It was basically trying to bring some accountability and some review of our information technology contracting practices. And we now have a chief information officer and Alex Pettit serving, you know, the governor's office on these topics. And so the original proposal was to create an office of the CIO and put all the IT contracting into that separate agency, into that office. And over time, I don't know that we have the amendments yet. So we should have had the amendments yet, but there is a dash one, I believe, that Senator Riley may speak to. There is a dash two and a dash three. So the dash two amendment I will speak to just briefly is one that we have worked on with the governor's office and Department of Administrative Services to really try to figure out how this would really work and accomplish our goals of having a chief information officer have the ability to review information technology contracts to make sure they're adequate, that they provide the proper oversight, and that they will meet the goals of the state. As you know, we've had some problems with IT contracts for a while, and it's you know, an ever-changing world, and it really deserved some attention. And so the dash two amendment, I think, is what it will be, but having not seen it, I'm not sure what number it is. But there is an amendment coming out that leaves the chief information officer under housed in DAS, but still has responsibilities and authority for these IT projects. And in fact, they provide directly and delegate by means of interagency agreement to provide all telecommunications and operations for state and state agencies. That if DAS retains that responsibility, but the CIO has a lot of discretion in reviewing the IT goods and services for the solicitation document, and is authorized to call for a cure of the contract or if the project's not meeting standards that are established by the CIO. And so there is a lot of checks and balances for the CIO to have oversight over these IT contracts. And the part of the reason that I think the state and the governor's office didn't want to quite move all the authority into a new agency at this point is because it does affect all agencies that have these type of contracts, where we do have expertise in actual procurement according to our public contracting code, which is sort of a slightly different topic than the IT contracts themselves. And so I think that the bill is a good idea as introduced, and I believe the amendment is also a very good incremental step in accomplishing the goals of having the proper oversight of information technology contracts. So I'll just leave it at that. I know that that DAS is here and will be able to testify on some of the specifics that they see in the bill, and I leave it to that. Happy to answer any questions that you may have of me.
Chair Fagan, committee. My name is Chuck Riley. I'm the senator from Senate District 15, which includes Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, North Plains, Roy, Verbort, and unincorporated areas in between. First, let me tell you a little bit about my background. I've been in the IT world for many years. I started in the Air Force in the 60s, and have been in IT ever since in increasingly responsible positions. I've seen many different ways that CIOs of corporations operate, and I believe that House Bill 3099 is, as introduced, is an extremely good bill. As the representative pointed out, the amendment that he's talking about might be a good incremental step, but I believe that the absolute best place for the state CIO is directly under the governor. One of the arguments that will be presented to leave it under the Department of Administrative Services is that provides more stability. And it's interesting that we've had a state CIO for 20 years now, and we've had 13 changes in the CIO office. That's it's hard to get less stable than that. So I think that, you know, when it's not working, we try something else. The current law already puts the appointment of the CIO under the governor and under the direction of the governor, but with consultation with the Director of Administrative Services. The 3099 takes the consultation out, but still leaves them under the direction. Although the bill doesn't say it, it still leaves them under the direction of the Department of Administrative Services. There are 24 states whose CIOs are directly under the governor, and one of those has the longest longevity of a CIO in the states. So I think that's that says something in and of itself. You know, it's clear that the effectiveness and the efficiency of the CIO would be enhanced by being an agency head and directly under the governor and not reporting to someone else who has possibly conflicting ideas. So I'll leave it with that. I have a written testimony that's on OLIS. I hope you'll all read that. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So I guess Senator Riley, you can answer this one. So obviously the big elephant in the room is Cover Oregon, and it's not really much use to ask what question is this trying to resolve, and that's not the only one, but that's a big one. But it strikes me that with Cover Oregon, that there was quite a bit of influence from the governor's office directly on that project. Doesn't this kind of mimic what went on informally during the Cover Oregon process, rather than the way it should have been to have DAS overseeing it, than to have Cover Oregon kind of responding to the governor kind of thing? Can you just comment on that?
Sure. Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman. I don't read that exactly the same way you do.
Okay.
The Director of Administrative Services was responsible for that project with the CIO underneath that director. And in fact, when the governor appointed a new DAS director, he immediately put the CIO completely over the Cover Oregon to clean up the mess that we had. And not only that, they put him directly over operations. The information, the data center and other operations to clean that up. And he's done a great job. Alex has done a wonderful job, and I believe that that's where the responsibility for all IT functions, including operations and procurement, should be.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Can I ask another?
Yes.
So, there's investigations going on right now with the emails leaked from DAS. How would this reorganization, how would that impact that investigation?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, my belief is that it wouldn't impact it at all. If you look at 3099, what 3099 does is it requires all functions, IT functions, under DAS currently to be placed under the CIO's office, and all responsibilities and ongoing duties. So that would be an ongoing duty, and I don't believe it would affect anything at all.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you both. Okay, now Barry Pack and Alex Pettit.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon. Prior to that, I was the first Chief Information Officer for the State of Oklahoma. I'm here today to provide some brief testimony on House Bill 3099. Let me say, on behalf of Governor Brown, I want to express our appreciation for the committee's focus on this area of state government operations. As this is a shared and timely area of interest, I'm happy to be able to express our support for the underlying concepts contained with 3099, namely the transfer of duties, powers, responsibilities related to IT, information resource management, information security, GIS systems, and telecom from the Oregon Department of Administrative Services and the DAS director to the state CIO, and confirming that the state CIO serves as the governor's primary advisor on all matters related to enterprise IT and telecommunications. With that, Governor Brown and I emphatically support the transfer of enterprise IT and telecommunications planning, coordination, oversight, rulemaking, standard setting, and policy adoption related to the duties, powers, and responsibilities from DAS and the DAS director to the state CIO. We welcome the opportunity to work with the committee on the amendment to the bill to accomplish this. At the highest level, we envision that the amendment changes will allow the Office of the State CIO to remain operationally within the Department of Administrative Services, but clearly confirm that the direction to and the authority and accountability of the state CIO comes from the governor. transfers the planning, policy, rulemaking, and standard-setting authority for the enterprise IT and telecommunications from DAS to state CIO, but retains DAS authority responsibility for IT operations to be conducted in a manner consistent with the state CIO plans, rules, policies, and standards. And it retains the DAS director's authority responsibility for IT procurement, but expands the state CIO authority considerably for IT procurement oversight in a number of meaningful ways. Again, we thank the committee for introducing this important and timely measure. That concludes the testimony, my formal testimony at this point, and I'll turn it over to Barry to go through anything he'd like to cover.
Thank you, Alex. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Chief Operating Officer with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm here just to express our support for the underlying concepts in the amendment that Representative Holvey was discussing earlier. I'm happy to walk through some of the specifics, although it might be better if we wait until you actually have an amendment to review, but I'll leave that to the Chair's prerogative. Otherwise, I can answer some questions as needed.
Okay. Questions for this panel? Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is just kind of a broad question. When reading this bill, I don't know if I'm understanding. This kind of takes a bite out of DAS and creates almost like a new agency, doesn't it? Like a CIO agency with the CIO as agency.
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, as introduced, the bill would do that. The amendment that we've been discussing with Representative Holvey and others would retain the office of the state CIO within DAS, but clarify the reporting structure to the governor and expand some of those authorities and duties within the state CIO office itself.
I need to wait for the amendment.
If I may also, Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, Oklahoma was equally blessed with many agencies. We had 132 individual agencies in the state of Oklahoma. This, rather than setting a separate and distinct agency for the Office of State CIO, it was housed in the Office of Management and Enterprise Services, or OMES, very similar to DAS. So it's a very similar structure where the CIO is appointed by the governor, and the activities, the responsibilities, the performance of the things is within the department of within OMES in Oklahoma. It would be within DAS here.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, Mr. Pettit, you've been on the job for how long?
Since January of 2014, sir.
So, Oregon has gotten the reputation of, let me put this nicely, not functioning highly with regards to their IT needs. Do you have an insight on why that is?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, yes, I would submit to you that our procurement has been challenging, and this bill is an attempt to address some of those deficiencies. But very candidly, where we die is in the build process. So we've got consult, design, build, and run. Those are the four steps to any IT project. And where we die is in the build. And we die in the build for a variety of reasons, mostly poor quality and poor process. That's really as simple as it is. One of the things that I did, it was February of 2014, I had introduced and then worked with the Legislative Fiscal Office to further define what we call a stage gate methodology for all projects. So all of our projects now go through, IT projects go through a staged process of incremental delivery. So although it doesn't assure or it won't necessarily, I don't promise every project will be a success. I promise that I will fail much faster and fail much less money than we have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Either of you can take this question. I've been, and maybe Barry, you're more appropriate because you've been around here longer. I've been told in the past that there's great concerns about the overall software infrastructure of the state of Oregon in terms of its accounting programs and payroll programs, that they're outdated, they're hard to repair, there's fixes that become increasingly difficult. Is that true? And if so, what's being done to address that problem?
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, that is true. Most of our sort of core business systems that operate within the government, so not the external facing programs that citizens interact with, but the accounting and the payroll and the HR systems, are all 20 plus years old, generally speaking. They're written in old language that we have a hard time recruiting IT staff who can code in COBOL any longer, and you know they are in need of replacement. We have begun an incremental process to do that, and one of the things that Alex has been asked to do is to put together what we've called a legacy system upgrade plan, so that we have a roadmap essentially over the next 5 to 10 years of how and in what order we might look to replace those systems with more modern systems. And what that also, though, requires is a fundamental look at our business processes, because one of the reasons we fail in the build is we build technology solutions to match poor business processes. And what we want to be able to do is standardize and lean our business processes so that they are easily alignable to off-the-shelf software that already utilizes best practices in the world of payroll, for instance, so that we have a standard process and that we're applying that to the software rather than trying to architect software to 120 different agencies' payroll processes.
Okay. Considering these are essential core functions of the state of Oregon, payroll and accounting, do you think a 5 to 10 year implementation plan is acceptable and a reasonable risk for the state of Oregon to take?
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, what we, and maybe Alex should fill in a little more detail, but what we did in putting together that timeline and plan was weigh a couple of factors: the stability of the systems as they exist, the need for improved processes or data coming from those systems, and the complexity of making a change. And so trying to, and also recognizing that there are things that come in order. You know, you can't do this until you've replaced that. So taking all of those factors into consideration and then balancing it with the fiscal impact, frankly, of, you know, largely replacing a number of systems. Yeah.
I just want to be on the record, I have a concern about that kind of timeline based on my conversations with people with inside knowledge of how potentially problematic a failure of our software systems. And just one final question. The Department of Revenue here has been one agency that's had particularly difficulties, had a failed software conversion, if I remember right. And it's been thought that there's hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe up to $1 billion of uncollected taxes because of that. Comment or about how you can help the Department of Revenue with regards to those issues?
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, first to your concerns around the timeline of replacing all those legacy systems, we'd be happy to sit down with you and kind of map through what we're looking at and have that dialogue and get your feedback on it. As to the Department of Revenue, they are in the phase two of a successful implementation of a new core systems replacement, so I'm not sure that I can answer the question. They've begun, I think, with their corporate tax system and are moving into the private tax this biennium, and they have a third phase next biennium. They've been regular reporting to the emergency board and the IT subcommittee, and that project's going very well. It's actually the example of a very strong success story for IT projects in the state.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I was hoping maybe you could just address, I guess, some of the fundamental differences and issues of why the introduced bill that creates the separate agency, complete with all authority and operational duties and everything in that office, as opposed to the Dash 1, or not the Dash 1, excuse me, the amendment that we don't have that talks about you know, keeping the office of the CIO in DAS, but without the operational duties, which include the actual procurement processes, and those fundamental differences, and why it seems like a better step, a better idea right now to keep the procurement and operational duties with DAS, as opposed to the policy, the oversight, and the fundamental review and authority over specifically the IT contracts with the CIO. And I mean, because I think those are the fundamental differences that we're looking at when Senator Riley speaks about supporting the introduced bill. And you know, I'm shedding some light on the amendment and why those fundamental differences and why we should go one way or the other, I guess. I think that'd be helpful.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Holby. In my experience from I guess it must be now 7 years in state service and then 10 years prior to that in municipal service, small agencies don't tend to fare well come budget time. Now, the way that Oregon has constructed services, there are 10 or 11 agencies that share services at the Enterprise Technology Center, ETS, the Enterprise Technology Services Group, and all the other agencies tend to support their own IT services. So they're very, it's a very federated system right now as it exists today, except under policy. Policy is very centralized, but the policy group is a very small group that I have, about, you know, 9 or so of us that are in the policy, the IT policy group. So it's a very small group that's enterprise-wide, if you like, or that affects, that sets the policies for the entire state. As a consequence, and even within ETS, ETS is not the largest IT provider of services in the state as far as headcount or any of those things. So when you begin setting up a service that's exterior to, that's an agency that's not, you know, with combined with policy and is an incomplete service delivery, you end up having a I don't want to say a dichotomy. It's really the paradox of policies that are good for the state versus setting policies that would help this group grow and survive and thrive over time, you know, trying to bring other groups into your orbit or what have you. The way that Oregon has approached this problem is separating service delivery from policymaking. So that was actually what I was originally hired to do, was to be the policy director for the state. That hasn't worked out as planned, but that was really the concept. And that service delivery would be done by service providers under my oversight and guidance and what have you, and rules and policies and things that I put forth. With the bill as it's constructed now, we would set up a small agency that I would submit to you would be on a path of dissolution over time. It would be struggling for resources. It would be in competition with other agencies' IT investments and budgets. And the net of it is it would be a very difficult thing to manage. In addition to that, I'm not sure the total number of agencies that the state of Oregon has. 132 for Oklahoma was quite enough. It gets to be very difficult to service. It gets very difficult to manage, and another agency does not really help alignment. And ultimately, the state of Oregon, in my, and speaking as an individual now, not representing the governor, the state of Oregon's core services is not IT. IT is a vehicle for providing these other services. We're a support mechanism. We're a tool for delivering services to constituencies, and more often than not, supporting the person that's delivering the services, whether it's public safety or public health or whatever the department is. So I don't see that it ought to be a core service. It's important. It's something that should inform policy, but I don't think it is in and of itself it's not on the same par as public safety. It's not on the same par as economic development. It's not on the same par as health, public health. It doesn't rise to that level.
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Holvey, I'll expand a little bit. Maybe I'll just walk through some of the changes that we've been working on, proposed in the amendment as a concept, and then we'll come back to you and we actually have the amendment. I think from our perspective in the COO's office at DAS, it's important for us to think on an enterprise-wide basis as we make decisions. So we have historically been very siloed into 92 state agencies and 312 boards and commissions, where we're very focused on those lines of work, or we're very focused on particular, either particular agencies or lines of work, and we need to be making choices and management decisions across all of them. And so it's important to have that visibility across the spectrum and to do it in coordination with the other functions that government does. So we have a chief information officer, we have a chief human resource officer, we have a chief financial officer. These are the folks who are guiding statewide policy that agencies follow on these very basic core support mechanisms in order to provide a delivery of service. And it just makes sense for us that while in the bill as introduced and then as amended, eventually perhaps if you adopt the conceptual amendment, the CIO would be directly appointed by and directed from the governor as sort of the top policy advisor as it relates to IT to the governor, that position would still be working in coordination with those other chief human resource, chief financial office in being able to make those decisions across the broad spectrum. In terms of some of the other changes that are anticipated in the amendment, you'll see in the current statute there's a lot of authority as it relates to IT assigned to the director of the Department of Administrative Services. And what a large chunk of the amendment and the bill does is essentially replace director with the state CIO for all things that are policy, oversight, standard setting, those sorts of things. It will leave then the provision of that service under the authority of the DAS director to provide directly or to delegate or to contract out as best sees fit. The amendment would also, as the bill does, assign a series of specific authorities and responsibilities to the state CIO and would put into statute that incremental delivery process that Alex had mentioned at a high level, so following a process that is set by the state CIO. We would see some changes to the procurement rules, giving the CIO authority to review procurement solicitation documents prior to their being sent out, giving the CIO the authority to be named a contracting entity in state IT contracts. That's important because what that establishes then is it gives the state CIO the right to issue a cure letter, a demand for a cure, to a vendor or a consultant who is not performing up to standards. So in the Cover Oregon situation, when you had multiple QA reports coming back showing deficiencies, had the state CIO been a party to that contract, he could have issued a demand for a cure. And if that cure was not met, then we could have facilitated a breach of contract earlier. So this doesn't require him to be in there, but it gives him that authority and some oversight there, as well as giving the CIO authority to review the IT procurement delegations that DAS might give to agencies. We, the DAS director, has the authority in statute to delegate certain contracting authorities to other agencies, and this would say that's got to get a review by the state CIO. There's other sort of broad oversight and authorities put in place, but I think those are generally speaking the primary changes that you will see in an amendment when it comes to you. Does that help, Representative Polby? Enough? Okay. Thank you.
Other questions, Representative McLean?
I want to build on that because that was my original question, but you know, what you just said gave me a little bit more comfort. I like to see the words, and so I'm looking forward to the amendment. But this, what I've heard since I've been here, and it's a short period of time, but it's just the idea that there were two issues. First of all, looking to make sure we get the right product, the best product for the need. So there's a need assessment issue. And then there's also the issue with not just the procurement of that, but also then the management of that. And so some of the things that you just said, the letter, the cure letter, the review, you know, the opportunity to bring into your office or the CIO's office the opportunity to say, hey, let's stop on this and let's wait a minute, let's coordinate, let's really get down and dig in there and see if this is what we need, or let's stop now. All of those are encouraging. But I guess I wanted to understand why. I get the part about the small and the large agency and, you know, getting lost there in the shuffle and not having resources. But I don't understand separating out the whole process. You know, I mean, if there's somebody in charge, the buck stops there. You're giving operations to DAS, and that's the part I don't understand. because, I mean, of course, one man, one person, one office is not going to take care of 92 agencies and all the needs and all the contracts. I get that. But it seems to me like it needs to be where all of the 92 agencies and all of the procurement processes have a particular process. You described one with four steps that everybody has to go through. And if you're in charge, well, they'd have to go through your four steps as far as I'm concerned. So can you kind of explain that? Because you're breaking up the package again. And I want somebody to be able to have some oversight to see if the package, part one and part two, really fit together and are working.
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, I guess I would answer in a couple of ways. Mm-hmm. Giving the oversight authority to the state CIO allows him to very clearly make sure that the service delivery and the IT projects are meeting standards and are meeting the business need, regardless of who's actually providing it.
Okay.
So whether it's an agency doing the work or whether it's DAS doing work, DAS does relatively few IT projects, with the exception of Representative Buehler's concerns around our core systems. It's the agencies who are developing the
okay.
projects. He will have oversight over those.
Okay.
He will, in partnership with LFO and you, be approving through the stage gate process these IT projects. The other thing to keep in mind, I guess, is from DAS's perspective, we have, over the last 5 years or so, taken the policy and the service provision responsibilities that we have for IT, accounting, finance, HR, procurement, all of those sort of core functions, and internally separated the policy setting from the service set provision. Because it's awfully hard as a service provider to also be the overseer and the cop. Okay. To say to your customers, I know you really want me to do this for you, but you can't. It's not the policy. They don't have any place to appeal that to. So if you have the service provider doing their best to focus on customer service, and you have a policy setting overseer separate from that, then you create some room for that dialogue and proper oversight.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative McLean, it was a very good question, and it does strike at the very heart of the of that enterprise model for service delivery, what they call here. And it wasn't something I was familiar with when I came here. In other states where they have done it, we have a hybrid model for service delivery. Some of the agencies provide their own service, and some of the agencies subscribe to a centralized service. That makes but the policy is universal. The policy setting is enterprise wide, is statewide for all state executive branch agencies. It is a difficult. And this is true in HR. This is true in the other services we have. DAS is not the sole provider of those services to all agencies. They provide some of the services to, whether it's HR services, they do it to a handful of agencies, whether it's IT services to a handful of agencies. They're not the universal provider, but they are the universal policymaker.
Okay.
And that's really the and it was a very difficult, again, it's taken me a year and change to get my brain wrapped around this, but that's really the I don't know what to call it, the imbalance mm-hmm. here that you sense, or as you point out, that paradox.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you for the question.
Representative Rayfield.
So, and in follow-up on Representative Buehler, what are the three most important, it doesn't sound like there's a lot, but what are the three most important IT projects that you guys have?
Well, from which side? From the policy side, we have Magi Medicaid. It's the first one that jumps to mind with the bringing. So that's, maybe I'm biased because I'm also acting as the chief information officer for Cover Oregon still through the end of June. So that one's got a lot of my attention, and I keep close tabs on that. The DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles Modernization Project, we got that one, as well as the DMV project for the, the fobs they're putting in the cars to track the gas tax, the pilot that's going on. That one's getting a lot of attention. We got the child support update. There's too many of them. I don't know which one. It's like you're asking me which of my children I like the most. It's a tough question to answer, and I don't know if I would do it publicly.
So. Follow up. That's helpful for me to get that kind of information. And when you have big projects like that, what's the timetable for completing things like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, it depends. And I know that's a bad question, but it does depend. So for the ODOT pilot for the gas tax, that one's got a very hard implementation date that we're shooting for. The Magi Medicaid project covering, you know, getting that converted, that has a hard date that we're working towards to get that done, what with the recent court appearance and things that have happened around that one. In other projects, we do try to not let the schedule dictate the performance or execution we try not to allow artificial deadlines to force things and decisions and activities that we would have to go back and fix later. So, you know, it all again, if there's a hard fixed date that I can't move to and I have to hit that date, then scope and cost are the two variables I have left to play with to try to achieve that hard time deadline. If possible, where we can, we like having all three of those tools available to us to meet the needs of the project that we're trying to do. So,
just one last quick follow-up. And you mentioned cost, and so I was just kind of curious how that plays into things and then where the funding comes from for these projects like that.
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, cost comes in when we're facing often with a hard deadline. Very often there's something else that has to give. So you have your project management triangle. You got cost, time, and budget, you know, and when you fix one or you say one is the most important, well, the only way, generally speaking, when unanticipated things come up, you've got to deal. If you've only got two other levers to pull, you got to reduce your scope, or you got to increase your burn, you know, to achieve it. That's with any project. That's really the three pieces, the three levers you have as a project manager. It's not just specific to IT. It's to any kind of a capital project. And so, as you get into those things, as you struggle with those things, when cost is also fixed, then really the only thing you're left with is cutting scope, you know, is cutting the project scope and saying, well, we're going to have to move that to a phase two, or we're going to have to put that off for now or whatever. And so it's really just the art of project management, to be honest with you, sir.
That's helpful. Thank you.
One more room.
Actually, Representative Buehler, sorry.
Yeah. Thanks, Madam Chair. Does the, speaking of policy, does the state of Oregon right now have a clear policy on the destruction or deletion of public records, including emails?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, the statute is pretty clear on that, and it gives the authority for those to the Secretary of State.
So if the governor instructed the chief information officer to destroy records or emails, what would be the protocol to follow?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, any destruction of public records are governed by the Secretary of State's retention schedules. And so if they are within the period of time that they would be retained, they would not be disposed of.
Yes.
Why wasn't the Secretary of State informed of the request to destroy emails earlier this year?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, that request was received and handled, I think, to the best of our abilities, following the guidelines that were set. It's also important to remember that at the same time or shortly thereafter, we received a federal subpoena, at which point those emails became more than just public records. They became potential criminal evidence, and so therefore they were following different protocols for protecting them.
So what was the Secretary of State's response when she was notified of the request to destroy emails earlier this year?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, I don't know. I was not involved in that.
How would you find the answer to that question?
I will track that down and get that back to you.
Representative Nerman.
Good. I think mine will be a lot easier. So, Mr. Pettit, on the services level that the DAS provides, what are the services other than data storage and networking?
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, there's actually a service catalog that's available, and in our next presentation, I think, well, that's coming up in a couple of weeks, they'll be going through the rates and the costs for those. There's extensive services that are provided. There's compute, so we have compute being there are a lot of servers that we host, you know, folks' servers. So you can get a virtual server, and we set that up for services. We provide database services. Microsoft SQL is hosted. Oracle is hosted. Several other databases for supporting software hosted software hosting platforms. We provide the base level security services to agencies that subscribe to the ETS services, base level meaning the central services, not to the desktop services. We do provide through TSC, we do provide desktop to the desktop security services. We do all of the compute, storage, networking, so all the networking and telephonics, so you know, all the connectivity, wireless networking, all that kind of thing. Anyway, there's a long listing of the services, 19 of which we actually identified through a process that we felt should be universal or utility in nature, and that all the agencies should be subscribing to one provider for those services. But that's another conversation. I don't know if you're interested in that.
Good, thank you. I expected that question would have been easier to answer.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. One little follow-up. Is it practical to get me a copy of that catalog?
Absolutely.
All right, good. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries.
All right, further questions? Okay, thank you guys for hanging in there.
Thank you.
More time than I had on my sheet for that bill, so good thing we don't have a full agenda today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 3099? Okay, with that, close the public hearing on House Bill 3099, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2528. Want to give us a reminder of that bill, if there's any amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2528 establishes a task force on citizen review of public works projects. It specifies the membership of the task force and directs the task force to study the need for and feasibility of establishing a review board to review, approve, and oversee public works projects. And there is a -2 amendment which limits the scope of the review board to public works projects undertaken by a state agency with a contract price of $30 million or more and involving geologically sensitive conditions. And that's the main part of the amendment. There is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
All right, thank you very much. And I will entertain a motion on the amendment.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 2528, dated March 31st, 2015.
Representative Rayfield has moved to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 2528, dated March 31st, 2015. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll take another motion.
And Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2528 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 2528 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Representative Holden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Buehler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Buehler?
Yes. And I'm assuming Representative Witt would like to carry this bill, so
goes to Ways and Means.
Oh, goes to Ways and Means. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Well, we'll let that be a note to them that he probably wants to carry it. Okay, with that, I'll close the public hearing, the work session on House Bill 2528 and open a work session on House Bill 3056. Give us a summary. I think there is also an amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. House Bill 3056 provides that a crematorium may not be certified by the state Mortuary and Cemetery Board if the proposed crematorium is determined to present a danger to public health and safety of children. The -2 amendment changes that reference And allows the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board to refuse to issue a certificate of authority to operate a crematorium or suspend or revoke the certificate if the board determines that a crematorium endangers public health and safety, and the board must consider whether the crematorium has met national industry standards for training and equipment. That is the dash two amendment, and there's no subsequent referral. The bill has no revenue impact, and it's been found to have minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 3056, dated April 2nd, 2015.
Representative Rayfield has moved to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 3056, dated April 2nd, 2015. Is there any discussion? I will just note that when Representative Kinigeyer approached me about the dash two, I know she's worked with the crematorium board and others, and basically because they're not sure that there is any harm caused, they removed certain language that kind of presupposed the outcome or presupposed harm, and so it makes it a little bit broader, and I don't believe there's any opposition to this bill, at least on record. So, all right, any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, you want to call the roll? Well, actually, no, this is on the amendment, right? So is there any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
And Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3056 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 3056 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
We first heard the bill come forward, and there were some witnesses who talked about some of the possible impact to their community health and issues like that. And there was some references to the EPA website, which I looked at. And then I also took some time and spoke with DEQ about this bill, trying to really learn more about it and how these crematoriums get permits through DEQ. And some of the issues was determining whether this actually does cause a health and safety, a public health issue. And through those conversations, I wasn't able to find an answer. And actually, DEQ, from my understanding and my interpretation of what they told me, is that there's really no way to be able to they have not set the standards on the public health side of things right now for this type of an emission. And so I don't know whether it makes sense to pass a bill like this yet not look at what actually constitutes a public health. There's a part of me that feels like we really should move this forward because you err on the side of caution until we do find that actually, kind of as a doctor would do, where you would rule out something. Okay, let's go ahead and actually implement this until we can rule out that this isn't a public safety issue, and then the board would have its own decision. And so I'm a little bit torn on this. I'm going to give it a courtesy yes vote to move it to the floor, and I'm going to continue to do some more research. But I potentially reserve the right to vote no on the floor a little later, and that's. And I know Representative Nierman had also spent some time trying to investigate this as well.
Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So I almost exactly echo Representative Rayfield's words, except the part where he says we err on the side of caution, because I believe we err on the side of freedom. But anyway, so I'm going to be a no vote for almost the exact same reasons. So we'll cancel each other out and call it good on that.
And I'm going to be voting yes, but I'm going to the two comments that were just made before us, I think, actually are addressed by the language or the words that we're voting on, because even if there is not something at the DEQ level, it still puts a burden of proof on the cemetery board if they were going to either revoke and or not give a license, and to be able to do that, they've got to come up with some, with some support. And so the support is actually going to be coming from whatever is in place at the DEQ. And to be honest with you, I cannot believe that there is not something that we could find if I took the time to call a DEQ that would talk about any kind. I mean, we have it on wood. We have it on wood burning. We have it on, what they allow us to burn in the backyard. And so if they have those types of what I would call criteria on what we can or cannot do because of emissions from that type of burning, I think that there has to be something else there that we could talk about. But I don't find this to be something that doesn't allow for more additional criteria and or process to happen. And that's my bottom line for my yes vote.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Stark.
There was only three of us that raised. Thank you. I'm going to be a yes on this, and because what I actually like about the amendments is that it's not declaring one way or another. It is actually putting the authority in the hands of the local board, and I think we need to do more of that, putting authority on the local level. And so to allow them to determine and work with the parties that be to decide if it's a health hazard and a problem for safety, then I think that's fully appropriate.
Representative Holvey.
Yeah, I suppose I might have a question of the representative from Corvallis and Philomath. You know, there's been a little bit of discussion about, you know, the DEQ and the hazards, though in this bill I don't see any references to anything like that. And it's just, so I'm kind of curious what the determination is that so it's a cemetery board that's making a determination of whether it presents a danger to health and safety, the way I read this. And in making that determination, it says they shall consider the standards for training and equipment used in the practice that are based on national industry standards. So I see no cross-section with DEQ, which has been in the discussion, or health. So can you explain that to me? Is it involved in those national standards?
So the way that I understand this, and getting back to a little bit what Representative McClain was talking about, DEQ does actually look at certain types of things. This is not one that they have developed standards for. So when this board, in its trying to attempt to make a decision on whether something is a public health concern, they have to have something to rely upon, have some information. And while this bill talks about certain things, that we haven't really spent the time, or we will not be giving the board the tools that they need to make an informed decision at this point. And that's the concern that I have. And what I wouldn't want is a board, I would want a board to be making sound decisions on, you know, scientific evidence, as opposed to just making a gut call on one way or the other. And that those were my concerns. And actually, when I spoke with DEQ, because the other issue for me is these folks are already permitted by DEQ, so I wanted to know, what were they permitting? Were they already permitting, and was DEQ saying that they are, actually safe, they were safe for the public? And what DEQ told me is, no, we're not actually looking at that component. So that public health side, they're not looking at, which is an argument in favor of a bill like this. But my second concern is, then once it gets down to the board level, and they're making a decision, and they have, you know, I want this to be based on scientific evidence, not on anything else, where we actually have some defined standards. And I don't feel like we have that right now. And we may pass this, and I think the board's going to be making decisions on guts, on their gut feeling, rather than, you know, actual scientific information. But at the same time, I do believe, so I was just flagging that. But at the same time, I do feel, you know, I will cast a yes vote, you know, an err on the side of caution, not freedom, but on the public health. I don't know if that, I think that kind of takes you down the path of how I looked at it.
I guess to follow up, my question really was, did you find anything in those national industry standards, or were you able to identify how those national industry standards are developed to look at public health and safety, or are they not?
So I did not look at the industry standards. I looked at more or less what a neutral, you know, a different body, how they were looking at this. And so the industry itself may tell us what they believe to be safe for public health. I would prefer to have something, you know, not industry funded. So
thanks.
Further discussion? Representative Buehler, did you?
You know, my points were made.
Okay.
You guys.
Okay, great. Seeing no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Representative Holby?
Yes.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Vice Chair Buehler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. All right, that, I believe, Rep. Kenny Geyer will want to carry the bill. So we'll sign her, and with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3056 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 584A.
Representative
Carter. Go ahead. Do you want to read us the summary here?
Madam Chair and members, Senate Bill 584A comes to us, I believe, from the Senate Workforce Committee, requires a contracting agency to suspend the right to submit a bid or proposal for a disadvantaged minority women or emerging small business enterprise that exhibits a pattern of failing to perform a commercially useful function. It extends the maximum possible length of suspension for some violations. Requires the Oregon Business Development Department to revoke a certification for the disadvantaged minority women or emerging small business enterprises after performing an investigation under certain conditions. Requires a contracting agency to notify OBDD when investigating a contractor for failing to perform a commercially useful function, and allows OBDD to conduct an independent investigation in response to the notification by a contracting agency. It becomes effective operative January 1st, 2016, and I don't have any amendments for the bill.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Frederick.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I'm here to help explain Senate Bill 584. Representatives from the City of Portland are here also to explain some of the details. You probably are used to seeing my face now when the subject of public contracts and minority and women-owned business enterprises comes up. This bill complements the one I brought to you earlier. It was proposed by the City of Portland because they would like to directly address some of the issues I relayed before within their own contracting system, but they need statutory authority that they don't clearly have to do so. The city receives complaints about fraud taking the form of certified minority-owned or women-owned businesses acting as fronts for non-certified firms on city-funded projects. This undermines efforts to support equity in contracting opportunities and represents misappropriation of public resources. Currently, local contracting agencies lack authority to take enforcement action when they receive evidence that this fraud is going on. This bill simply clarifies that a contracting agency may suspend a bidder from participation in future projects when they find that the bidder has flouted the rules by failing to perform a commercially useful function or by committing outright fraud. It also clarifies that the Oregon Business Development Department may consider findings from contracting agencies that indicate a pattern of failing to abide by the rules when considering certification, recertification, or revocation of certification of a business as a minority or women-owned business. You might ask, what is different about this bill as compared to the bill that already passed the House? Well, they are different parts of one picture. House Bill 2716 addressed the problem of firms that fail to remain qualified during the term of a contract. This bill addresses fraud in bidding for and performance under a contract. This bill also provides authority for contracting agencies, like the City of Portland, to take limited but significant and direct actions to protect the integrity of the contracting process and the integrity of minority contracting goals. We're trying to address a number of issues here in different ways, and this is a city effort. We've had some good conversations with the city, and I believe they've already started their process in the city council itself, but this is an attempt to allow much larger efforts across the state. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Representative.
City of Portland, I believe, is here, and a number of other folks to testify. So.
That's right. So we'll call up Andy Smith, Christine Moody, and Margie Solinger. Please begin when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andy Smith for the City of Portland. With me today is Margie Solinger. She's the Ombudsman for the City of Portland, and Christine Moody. She's our Chief Procurement Officer. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 584. The City of Portland has received a number of complaints from state-certified MWBE firms over the last few years that some state-certified firms were obtaining work on city projects and then passing the work on to non-certified firms to actually do the work. The statutory term for those actions is failing to perform a commercially useful function. The common understanding of those actions is fraud, and this fraud, as Representative Frederick mentioned, undermines both the city and the state's efforts to support opportunities for certified firms on city projects and on state projects. And it also represents a misappropriation of our limited public resources. The City of Portland and other local contracting agencies lack authority under the current law to take enforcement action against state-certified firms that fail to perform a commercially useful function. Over the past 10 months, the City of Portland has met with Business Oregon to figure out the best approach for closing the gap in enforcement over cuff violations. And the legislation before you today represents an approach that came out of several discussions between Business Oregon and the City of Portland. And now I'd like to take just a minute to walk you through a few of the key points of the legislation. In Section 3, Subsection 1, is the part of the statute where local agencies have concurrent enforcement authority with the state. Local agencies do not have concurrent enforcement authority over Subsection 2. So to address that, we added Subpart D to Subsection 1 to clarify that local agencies can enforce cuff violations. Also in Subsection 1, we changed the length of time agencies can suspend an MWBE firm from bidding on or receiving an award of a public contract from 90 days on the first instance to 1 year, and from 1 year on the second instance to 3 years. And finally, in Section 2, Subsection 3, we've clarified that if a local agency does the enforcement under that section of statute, which deals with other fraudulent conduct that is not a cuff violation, that the local agency can keep the statutory fine when it results from a local enforcement action. We amended the bill in the Senate for the general contractors to ensure that this bill did not impact current projects and to sort out a few technical issues for Business Oregon. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. We'd appreciate your support on this bill, and we're happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. I assume more people. Go ahead. Was that the whole panel?
No, we're good.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. They're here to answer questions.
Oh, they're here to answer questions. Okay. Questions for this panel? Yes.
Well, when you were in my office the other day, the one thing I just want to make sure is clear, because I want to thank the City of Portland for being willing to take on enforcement when some of these state-certified folks are not following through or doing their job. But in our conversation, we still need the state to take over and to make sure that we are following through with any state projects. You are just getting permission to do any projects within the City of Portland. Is that correct?
Chair Fagan and Representative McClain, that's correct. We're trying to address a pretty narrow issue that's occurring in our city and is impacting our local program around opportunities for certified firms to get work on our projects.
So just quickly, I really want to thank you. This solves our problem in Portland, but it doesn't solve our problem necessarily in other cities, nor does it solve our problem on state projects. And so I want to talk to Business Oregon a little bit about that, because from the discussions you folks have had with them, there may be a situation where they don't feel that they have the personnel or the opportunity or the ability to do that. And I want to find out why. Because if they're supposed to be the agency or they're supposed to be the group at the state level that is to go in and do what the city is going to do within their own boundaries, how do we handle it? And that's not a question.
Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So this kind of law is a little bit new to me. So what if I'm a contractor with the city and I bid on a contract? I'm a minority contractor and I bid on a contract as a minority contractor. And then after I get into the contract or something like that, I have difficulties or something like that, and I hire a non-certified minority contractor or disadvantaged business contractor to whatever do 25% of the work or something like that. Where do you draw the line as to where the fraud starts or something like that? I get it if I'm just a broker, then I'm committing fraud and not doing a meaningful
commercially useful function.
Yeah, commercially useful function. But anyway, just can you speak to that?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, Christine Moody with the City of Portland. In that instance, if those 25%, we would view that as a subcontracting opportunity. And since the city is different in the respect that it doesn't have hard goals and we have aspirational goals, that would be viewed as a subcontracting opportunity. And there's a process within the city as far as switching out subcontractors on projects. So if they had originally proposed a minority-owned subcontractor for that scope of work and they're switching it to, then if it's new work or if it's a non-certified firm, we have a process to make sure that certified firms were outreached to for that specific work, and then we approve that substitution. So there's a kind of an administrative process that runs through before that happens.
So I'm trying to get at, where's the line then? So let's say that I were I'm a minority contractor and I bid with the city and I want to swap out 100% of it. I just have to go to you to get approval. Then somewhere you've got, and you and I both agree that that's probably fraud, but somewhere you have to have some sort of thing where you said, no, Nearman swapped out 25% and we okayed that, or Nearman's swapping out 95% and that's not okay. Somewhere between 25 and 95, there's a line somewhere that you draw. What governs that?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nearman, I think there's actually a definition for commercially useful function, and so that's different than a subcontracting opportunity. Mm-hmm. So as a certified firm, and I don't know all the nuances of it, but a certified firm needs to be performing those types of functions in order to be an established business. So they need to have control over their business. They need to be able to make business types of decisions. And so that's different than swapping out work, because that's a different nuance in contracting as far as subcontracting out, or actually, for lack of a better word, being a front and, mm-hmm. and having a name on a piece of paper, but yet you have different trucks and workers coming in performing the work, and that's where you get into that line of the commercially useful function.
Do you know where that I'm sorry, can I follow? Do you know where that definition is? Is that in state statute, or is that
in the bill?
Or if you can, sure. Could you just get that to me? Right. Or is it in the bill?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nearman, it's on page 4, line 28. I think you can find the definition there.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions for this panel?
So I'm trying to discern what happens if this fraud is discovered, you know, of a contractor or a subcontractor. What's the consequence? Is the consequence just that they aren't eligible to finish the contract, or they're not going to be able to contract in the future, or is there a criminal fraud piece in this? I'm curious about what the consequences are.
Sure. Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey. So we worked with the general contractors in the Senate to amend the bill to clarify that it didn't apply to current projects. So we wouldn't be in a position where we'd be suspending certified firms from completing work on projects they're already working on. It would apply to their ability to bid or propose on future contracts. And the penalties under the statute for that, which we've changed, are 1-year suspension from bidding on the first instance of a finding of failing to perform a commercial useful function, 3 years on the second, and then 5 years on the third instance.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. James Posey. Just state your name for the record and go ahead and begin.
Thank you very much. My name is James Posey. Chair Fagan, other committee members. I am a former president of the National Association of Minority Contractors. I'm also the economic development coordinator for Coalition of Black Men, and more importantly, I'm a minority contractor. I'm here to speak on behalf of this particular bill because it has a very direct impact on organizations I represent and other minority contractors. You just heard the City of Portland make the recommendation for this bill, And you're correct. They are courageous because other cities and other organizations, including state organizations, aren't as effective in terms of presenting this bill. And you might ask why this bill is necessary in some ways, because actual minority contractors who see this fraud, this manipulation of the process, are afraid of retaliation. They're already not getting contracts at certain levels, and so therefore they would be less likely to want to, as you might say, whistleblow on people who they know are committing fraud. I could give you examples after example. In this particular examples that have been given to you thus far, just the tip of the iceberg. I would also suggest to you, Representative McClain, that if you're interested, you can go back to the DOT, the Department of Transportation, IG, or Office of Inspector General report back in April 23rd, 2013, and you can find an assessment of the DBE program, which is the origin of the commercial use of function language. And you'll find that in that OIG report, there was a very critical assessment of how the state agencies and recipients of federal funds are administering the DBE program. So this is why you find this abundance of fraud and abuse in the program. Let me just hasten to say that this is more than just about contractors. These programs were designed to mitigate some of the tragic situations that are happening in communities of color. High rates of unemployment, disparities in housing, on and on and on. And there's a litany of issues that affect our state. Your prison population is reflected in the impacts of whether or not people of color get a real shot at doing work on projects, et cetera, et cetera. So this is more than just about providing some oversight. It's about also the stewardship, the accountability of programs that affect people of color and the lack of intensity on there. When there's no policeman on the beat, then folk will take advantage of anything and everything, and that's what's been happening with these programs. And you're right to look at the ODOT and your state projects because they have very similar issues and problems. And so I just wanted to, in closing, say that the city of Portland really represents many, many years of pounding on them, as it were, because you'll go back to the 1996 disparity study, which you all participated in, that I'm sure that predates many of you sitting on this committee. But the 1996 disparity study identified this as a very substantial problem in the absence of participation of minority contractors on projects. And it's continued unto this day. Some of you will remember a guy in ODOT by the name of Bob Botheman, who was the chair of the Department of Transportation back during those days. So I'll stop with that and say I'll be happy to ask or answer any questions you might have of a minority contractor. I've did trucking, asphalt paving, excavation, and I'm on the verge of retiring, but I'm still pretty active in the community. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
I just had a question. Were you referring to me when you were saying that some of us might not have been in the panel in 1996?
Well, I kind of got a suspicion that you were somewhere.
He's just a kid.
you were somewhere bringing in. You may have been in junior high school or something like that.
Thank you very much. Further questions? Yes.
Thank you for coming forward and sharing your experience on this. When I'm looking at this and I'm listening to this issue come up, you know, it's pretty clear that it's, you know, some level of fraud as people have described it. And, you know, when I'm looking at that, fraud usually, you know, takes more than one person to know about it. And I guess I'm sort of alarmed that the penalty for this type of fraud is seems to be a 1 year suspension of your ability to bid a job, and that these penalties seem very minor compared to the level of the violation to me. And how is that really going to impact changing the behavior of people doing this if, you know, they jeopardize losing their right to bid for a year, you know, because this really seems like fraud to me. You know, it's not just, you know, a mistake, you know. And so I don't know. Do you see the penalties involved in this as really making a difference?
Well, I'm really even frightened to discuss that with you because...
Fair enough. Don't.
Well, you know, after many years of pounding about this issue, this is a step in the right direction. Quite candidly, many contractors will see this as a price of doing business.
That was my point.
Yeah, there's the price of doing business. But I want you to understand, people have beat on me long enough to know that if you're making progress, shut up and take what you can get. Uh-huh. And, you know, keep rolling. Hopefully someone like yourself would, you know, do a cost-benefit factor relative to the impact. And I see this, and I came, you know, people didn't talk to me about making that kind of testimony. We're very fearful that this won't even pass because there's no advocacy on the part of minority contractors or people who have been in this situation for many years. There's no advocacy out there. Senator Frederick is one of the first one who's been there, and he will counsel me to shut up sometimes and just get what you can get. But at the end of the day, there's messages being sent. And this could be a shot across the bow, so to speak. And so with that in mind, I'm happy to see this pass and commend the city of Portland after many, many years to move forward on making this agenda top on their priority. They, after all, have the ultimate responsibility for stewardship for what happens in the city of Portland.
Thank you. And just a comment, I think I agree with Representative McClain is, you know, I think this issue is not just Portland, and we would be wise to heed that. And I don't know, I feel this bill doesn't quite go far enough for the issue that's involved.
Maybe I missed something, but why is it just restricted to Portland?
Well, I think it's about the city of Portland coming forth. I could go back and give you a little history that several years back there was a mayor who this issue was brought to who declined to bring it forth and made representations that it was not in their purview, et cetera. Since then, we've had a change in administrations. We have a person in the ombudsman who is a courageous individual. She sees fairness and equity as a part of her agenda. And I think in many ways it relies on the personal accountability of people to step forward, do the right thing. That's why it's happening with the city of Portland, to be quite candid with you.
Chair Fagan and Representative Buehler, the bill is not limited just city to Portland. It just allows any local contracting agency, if they want to set up a process to do this kind of enforcement. It gives them the authority to do that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you guys very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And finally, Ivo Tremmer.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ivo Tremmer, Legislative Affairs Manager for the Oregon Business Development Department of Business Oregon for short. We house the Webb's Video Office for Minority Women and Small Merchant Businesses, the Certification Office. We've worked hard with the City of Portland over the last few months to make this bill, a mutually very useful tool, and we are very happy with what has come out. I wanted maybe to clarify just a couple of things here, what the bill does. Ultimately, it clarifies the authority that the department and Webb's has in terms of certification, decertification of businesses, and the ability to consider CAF violations as we learn about them from the contracting agency. That's the second part I think that's very useful for the City of Portland, but any other local government or state agency is the ability to actually do their own CAF investigations. One, so it's not limited, and I think Andy has established that it's not limited just to the City of Portland. The second part is, and maybe Representative Holvey, if I may add that to the quote-unquote punishment, it, ultimately it gives us the ability to decertify a company, so to exclude them from ever bidding again from a contract anywhere in the state, if you will. But it clarifies the authority of the contracting agency and for the department. We think that makes it very useful tool for us.
I do have questions. Yeah.
Could you explain to me what is the department's process for, like, they have an ombudsman, so if there's complaints, then they go to her, and they go to that office, and then she can investigate or she can decide how she's going to go forward. So what happens in this department as far as dealing with state contracts where we may have some of the same issues? What's the process?
So the two different levels, if you will. I'll start with the federal program, the DBE program, which is not in this bill. But the DBE program, really, where the federal hard dollars are attached to ODOT's efforts, ODOT itself will do the investigation and will look at CAF violations. They do about, give or take, 300 CAF investigations a year with 20-plus staff to look at that. So they will determine if there's fraud or if it was a correct. Their audit function, if you will, is mandated by federal funding. So they will handle their own thing. We will, as the state agency, look at the certification of the companies if it warrants that DBE certification. Similar here, it will be up to the state agency or to the contracting or the City of Portland in that case, the entity whose contract it is, and ultimately has the ability to look at whether the contract was fulfilled or not, which is less, and then to let us know that, to let us know their findings, one that they're investigating, and then the findings of the investigation.
Well, can I just follow up with that then? So I think I understood all that, but I'm just saying if I'm a person and I feel like I have a situation like that and it deals with ODOT or it deals with another agency, how do I as a citizen, you know, get that complaint into a process where there's some kind of a, I mean, you said that ODOT would do it themselves. Where did they, I mean, it's a state project. It's not a Portland project. Mm-hmm. It's not a Salem project. Mm-hmm. It's a state project. So how does that get initiated?
For ODOT, where it's tied to the federal funding, it's built in. They have
not
to audit.
Federal funding. Let's
not
just say
federal,
state funding.
The state
then.
Funding. For the state, similar, I think for the City of Portland, these are aspirational goals. So if you as a citizen or you as Representative McLean have an issue, I we do get calls.
Okay,
all the
so
time.
You get calls.
Mm-hmm. We get calls. I'm sure the City of Portland got calls. Sorry.
Okay.
So.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And all these investigations that the department has done on this, have they ever revoked a license on this?
I would have to check what the numbers are. Representative Holvey, I'd be happy to get back to you on that one.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have questions?
That's good.
All right. Thank you, Ivo. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on Senate Bill 584A? All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 584A. And is there anything else for the good of the order? All right. We'll close the public hearing on, or the House Committee on Consumer Protection Government Effectiveness.
Nicely done.
Consumer Protection Government Effectiveness.